critical thinking. What hinders us from doing this? Number one is sin. Sin. And it sounds like this is true because I want it to be true. Man's first sin was the desire to be like God, to be autonomous or entirely self-controlled. Because man, the fallen man, yearns for autonomy, he embraces ideas from a desire to sin freely and without accountability, not from an impartial search for truth. Therefore, the root cause of wrong thinking is a hardened heart and a darkened mind. I was raised Roman Catholic, I think I've told you, but became an agnostic and a skeptic in high school and then especially in college. My favorite activity was to attend Bible studies that Christians were having at my university and disrupting them with all my pseudo-intellectual questions and skepticism and challenges. And I liked that because generally I was smarter than they were and I knew my stuff better than they did. And so I'd end up winning all the arguments. And the reason I liked that is then I could just continue to sin. I wasn't confronted with Christ. And the person that actually led me to Christ is the person who refused to argue with me. I'd go to his room, and I'd start off, and I'd go into my whole tirade. And he'd sit there kindly and listen. At the end, he'd say, I have no idea. I can't answer any of your questions. But I know one thing is that Jesus Christ loves you, and he wants to change your life. And I hated that. I just hated that. But I kept coming back. I was thinking the other day when I turned 60, you know, just reflective, thinking about my life. And saved at 19. I really knew that there was a God and that I had to serve him. I wouldn't face it because I wanted to believe that there was some other alternative. You know, anything but that. But deep within, I knew. And that's why I worked so hard to come up with all these alternative ideas. Because that insulated me, protected me from the Bible, and enabled me to continue to live in sin. And that's the nature of the human heart. That's why Paul writes to the church in Ephesus, beware of this tendency. He says, don't live any longer like the Gentiles do in the futility of their mind, darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in them, because of the hardness of their heart. And they, having become calloused, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity and greediness. You see, we see the progression here in this text. So they're living in the futility of their mind, and their understanding is darkened. And because their understanding is darkened, they're excluded from the life of God. It's the ignorance that excludes them from the life of God, but they're ignorant because their heart is hard. So man's problem is never intellectual. It's always moral. It's always a heart issue. So we make a mistake when we try to argue with people and we just engage their mind. Because the mind's not really the issue. The mind is the method that we use to protect ourselves or to enable us to continue to justify our sin and live the way that we want to live. And real effective gospel evangelism deals with a person's heart as much as with trying to deal with all his objections. And, you know, you have to address people at their mind level, but, you know, you're really trying to get to the heart, because the reason why they believe the things they believe is so that they can sin the particular way they want to sin. That's the bottom line. It's about sin. It's about morality. And so, you know, as believers, then we come into Christ, and the axe is laid to the root of the tree, but there's a lot of that remnant within us. And so what hinders us from critical thinking, from evaluating and analyzing, and from actually coming to the knowledge of the truth is that there's still sinful patterns in our heart. Because every time we're confronted with new truth, it demands something new of us. We have to live differently. We have to have more self-sacrifice, more whatever. And so the biggest hindrance, the initial hindrance to critical thinking, is indwelling sin that's still a reality in all of our hearts. The second hindrance to accurate critical thinking is prejudices. Prejudices. It's true because we've always believed it was. This is how we believe. It's our prejudice. It's called sociocentrism. It's when I continually assume that the dominant beliefs in the group to which I belong are true, even though I've never questioned the basis for these beliefs. Sociocentrism. So you find this in particular social groups, right? Either whole nationalities, whole ethnicities, or even subgroups among ethnicities. They have inborn, innate prejudices. This is the way we do it. This is the right way. And they assume that their way is the right way. And so this is one of the basis of racism, is because other people who do it differently, that's different than us, they're the others. There's something inherently evil or wrong about that. But sociocentrism also affects us in church settings. Sociocentrism is when the only people that we're listening to are our own voices, the people within our own group. Because we assume that the dominant beliefs of our group, these are true, and we don't listen to people beyond our group. I mentioned yesterday that every year I have a little, just a spiritual discipline that I like to go through. I've been in my life tremendously influenced by a number of the popular faith preachers. And I know it's not popular to mention that. It's more popular to bash the faith preachers. And, you know, certainly there are plenty of things that we could bash. And yet, God's taught me faith through them. And I deeply appreciate it. So every year, I got a little routine I go through after there's a conference that happens every year. And afterwards, I download those, and I listen to them. I just want to just get a fresh infilling of faith. But every year, they get a little crazier. Every year, their theology just gets a little bit more off the radar. You know, you know who I'm talking about, right? I mean, the guys that are most associated now, the main person I listened to was Kenneth Hagin, but he's dead. But the main people, of course, Kenneth Copeland is usually the main guy that's associated with. He does a big believers conference every year. And the same people speak there, Creflo Dollar and Keith Moore and Jerry Savelle and Jesse Duplantis. And if you're familiar with those names, those are like the main faith preacher guys. And so I listen to that every year. But every year it gets crazier and crazier. And this year I downloaded them and it was just too crazy. I ended up just deleting them, the files. I couldn't even listen. And I was sad about that because I do like a faith recharge every year. And of course, I wouldn't recommend anybody, other people listening to them because there's more bones than there actually is meat. You know, we have an expression, eat the meat and spit out the bones. But, you know, I've been some places, and I've been served some meals where there was actually more bone than there was meat. And that actually there was so much bone, it wasn't even worth trying to wade through it to get the meat. That's what it was like this last year listening to them. I'm sure if I listen long enough, there'll be a little bit of meat, but I'm just spitting out bone after bone after bone. I'm just getting tired of bones. And so I'm not even going to bother to listen. And I realize one of the reasons why that's happening is because they only listen to themselves. That's just a part of their ethic, right? They speak negatively about other parts of the body of Christ and other individuals and other groups and other viewpoints. It's somehow that's not faith, that's religion, and all sorts of different ways that they frame it. But in essence, what that does is it causes them to be inbred. You understand what I mean by that term? We have a few places left in our country, in the mountains of West Virginia and in the swamps of Louisiana, where really isolated people groups that have essentially inbred over the years. I mean, they marry first cousins and, you know, maybe even closer relatives than that. And inbreeding always produces mental, physical problems. And you know, you see some of these people, and they're the result of inbreeding. Well, there's a kind of a spiritual inbreeding that takes place when all you do is listen to the same people, the people who already agree with you. That's sociocentrism, you know. And so I've been watching this over the last 10, 20 years in the faith movement. They've gone from pretty good, a lot of meat with, you know, some bones, to mostly bones with very little meat. And I think one of the main reasons is sociocentrism. The only people they listen to is one another. And that's like inbreeding, and it produces strange children. Strange looking children. But you know that can happen to us in Victory in every nation. We just listen to one another. And then we don't grow. I make it a point. Most of the people that I read and listen to are not every nation people. And I do that on purpose, is because I don't think we've got a lock on the truth. I think we got a lot of it. And everybody to listen to, I wouldn't want to be in their movement. I appreciate what they have to say, but I'm an every nation man, you know. If you cut me, I just bleed every nation blue. It just comes out. You can't get rid of me. I mean, you can fire me. I did. I get fired 9 years ago because we ran out of money. I just, people wonder, well, what's he going to do? I said, don't have to wonder about me. I got nowhere else to go. I'm here. I'm an every nation man through and through. But I deliberately listen to outside speakers all the time because I don't want us to grow. I don't want to just inbreed, you know, just listen to one another, and all we do is hear one another talk. Is all those influences, I want to take them and filter them and see what they have to add to us so we keep getting better and better and better and better. Because if all you do is listen to your own people, then you're never going to be challenged in what you believe. General Patton was a great American war hero. Do you know, are you familiar with him? Probably best known for the movie that George C. Scott portrayed him. And interesting character. I read a book by his aide-de-camp that was his right-hand man. He wrote a book called A Handbook for Managers Who Mean Business. It was a business book, you know, for management principles from the life of George Patton. And one of Patton's principles, one of the things he always said is, nobody's thinking if everybody's thinking the same. Nobody's thinking if everybody's thinking the same. It takes that outside thinking. And you know, that helps us with our prejudice because we have our own every nation prejudices. We have our own victory prejudices. We have a tendency to think a particular way, to process truth a particular way. And that's, you know, that's fine. It's good. It's who we are. But we want to be aware of sociocentrism and those prejudices will hinder us from really evaluating even our own ideas and therefore getting better and improving and increasing. And of course, it's one of the reasons the denominations tend not to change. So a denomination, they come on the scene, God does something very exciting in them, there's something new and fresh, but they sort of crystallize around those basic ideas, and then the next generation stagnates, and then pretty soon you just have a stagnate denomination that's holding on to their particular views and not open to outside ideas. That's a possibility, and that's prejudice. Number three, another hindrance is fear. Fear. It's true because I don't want it to not be true. So fear of finding out you've been wrong, maybe for a long time. You know, that's disconcerting. I had an experience 9 years ago that I began to realize slowly that my approach to preaching and my approach to the Christian life was really more moralistic than it was gospel-centered. And I had a dramatic transformation. I mean, to me, it was not unlike being born again. And I had to acknowledge that for 30 years, a lot of the things that I taught and said, I wouldn't teach them and say them now. And that's hard, you know, to think 30 years of your life, you know, a lot of things you said, you don't think that way anymore. And so that fear can hinder us from critical thinking, examining our ideas because of the possibility, you know, we might have to throw out most of our old sermons. I mean, the longer I live, the more of those old sermons have to go. Also, there's another fear, the fear of challenging authority, right? This is under fear, so fear of finding out you might be wrong, or a fear that those in leadership, maybe what they're teaching or saying needs some adjustment, and you're the one that needs to help them. Well, that's fear. And then the last one is laziness. Laziness. It's true because it's just easier to believe it. It's just easier to what I believe already. It's the person who prefers being given the correct answers rather than figuring them out for themselves. Do you find that's true with your church people? That they just want you to tell them? I think that's true with church people in general, but in my experience, I've been here in 8 years, and from an outside perspective, it seems to be more true in the Philippines than other places. That is my experience. And maybe one of the reasons I don't seem to be very popular among the average Every Nation congregation. I don't get many invitations to speak. Pastor Steve was here the first part of my trip, and the Sunday he preached here at the fort, I was there, and he said, "How come you're not preaching somewhere?" I said, "I don't think anybody wants me preaching." He said, no, they just probably just didn't know. No, I think they know. I just don't think they want me. And I understand. I don't think I connect with the average Filipino. I think my main connection is with leaders. And I'm okay with that. I'm content, you know. Because I find that when I speak in congregations, I think they're dissatisfied because I didn't give them steps or keys or what to do now. You know, I just don't do that. That's just not how I do it. You know, I want them to have an encounter with the gospel when I preach. And they want to know, okay, that's wonderful, that's great. Tell me what to do. I was joking with the guys yesterday when early on, I think first year or two, we celebrated our 30th year of my oldest son had turned 30. And so we did a parenting seminar, the first one we'd ever done, called 30 Years of Parenting. And what I try to do is I try to examine parenting from a theological principle basis. And Ariel had me down at Alabang, and it was a total bomb. Just a complete failure. Because people wanted to know, the main questions that they kept asking is, how do I spank my 3-year-old? And questions like that. They want to know, tell me what to do. I said, I haven't spanked a kid in I don't know how long. I don't remember. I'm trying to get you to think about parenting from a biblical perspective. And I realized they didn't want to think. They wanted me to tell them, here's what you do. Step A, B, C, D. Is that just my experience, or do you have anybody want to confirm or back that up? Yeah. Talk to me.
Pastor Paul, while you were talking about this, I remember growing up in school, and most of the way we do the education system here is we were thought to be employees. We were thought that when we graduate, we will find a job, but we are under a supervision or the authority of our boss.
Yeah.
So that thinking maybe was brought up eventually to the church and even to the family, that who is in authority, I'm just here to follow and to get the information and allow me to do it.
Yeah.
That's the environment.
Yeah, I'm sure that's an influence. Yeah. Any other thoughts about this? Yeah, Adrian.
I was recently, a couple asked me for an advice on the decision that they will make. The guy wants to buy this more expensive car, and then the girl wants to buy this lesser expensive.
Of course, as always.
And then they want...
You never get the reverse of that, right?
And then the guy was telling me about he prayed for it, the woman has no faith and all of these things, but the girl is saying... I did some computation. These are the data. These are the things that we can and all of this. And they were asking me, what will we do?
Yeah.
And so I told them to whatever. I want you to think through this, talk about this. But I hope at the end of the day, you will agree. If you are not in agreement, then don't decide unless you are in agreement.
Yeah.
So pray for one another that they will agree with you, or maybe you have a change of heart, you humble your heart, someone will sacrifice or someone will submit.
Yeah.
So, but they were waiting for me.
They want to know how.
They want an exact answer from me if the guy is right of having faith and if the girl is right of having facts and data. So they end up frustrated for not giving them an answer.
Right, yeah.
What car to buy for their family.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. I think that's how most congregations feel when I speak. They're just frustrated. Like, tell me what to do.
Yeah, I think I can relate also to that kind of situation that you're encountering. And I think that's also why I'm not really popular in terms of couples actually counseling and asking for advice. Or even some of the people in my staff, they don't like coaching when I do coaching with them, because
they don't like your coaching.
Yeah, because for them, coaching is really literally telling them what to do. But for me, coaching is really helping them understand or letting them get into a conclusion or owning or what should I do, or getting ownership and taking ownership in that. So it's really more of that. I don't know if it's laziness, but maybe, but I think it's really something.
It's a combination of a lot of things, yeah.
So that's why I can relate with that, nobody seems to like you, but it's okay.
I think you guys like me, so that's good enough. I just know when I come to the Philippines, I just speak to leaders, so that's good. I don't get involved in the congregations. Let's think. We'll see where we want to go here. Okay, let's move on to the next section then. What attitudes are necessary for critical thinking? Necessary attitudes for critical thinking. Intellectual humility. Number one, humility. I must be aware of how little I know. And this is a starting point of critical thinking. The goal of education, or one of the goals of education, is to help you realize how little you know. Now, often it's just the opposite. Paul tells us that knowledge tends to puff up. So it's too often people who get a lot of information, they get proud because they know stuff that other people don't know. But the proper fruit of intellectual achievement and growing intellectually is it should produce a deep humility, an awareness of how little I really do know. And that's necessary for critical thinking, that there's a basic humility, that you realize no matter how skilled you might be as a thinker, you can always improve your reasoning abilities, and you will always, at times, fall prey to mistakes in your reasoning. Human irrationality, biases, distortions, uncritically accepted social rules and taboos and self-interest, all these affect our thinking. And to really be a good critical thinker, you have to have a basic humility. I am prone to make many mistakes. And so I come to this process with an attitude of humility. I think that's part one, and that's the foundation. But part number two is intellectual honesty. Once you have intellectual humility, you need intellectual honesty. Honesty means I must be willing to challenge everything, regardless of the source. The simple believes everything, but the prudent gives thought to his steps. The simple believes everything. There's a cult group here in the Philippines that have those white churches that all look the same. What are those called? What's that place? No. Iglesia something? Yeah, don't all the church buildings look the same?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah. So, obviously, the people who are there are deceived, following their leader, not challenging, blindly following. We can talk about them, but we might be guilty of the same thing. Now, we're not following erroneous doctrine, but that same mentality, just listen and receive without challenging or questioning, it's really the same thing that they're doing, that we would criticize them. We may be guilty of doing it. So critical thinking requires the intellectual honesty to realize I have to challenge everything regardless of the source. That means even if it's my leader. Now, of course, the one exception is God's word. We never challenge that source. But regardless of who, it might be a person that we trust and trust greatly. But even people that we trust will make mistakes. And even the people that we trust still have indwelling sin in them. And not only will they make mistakes out of honest, innocent mistakes, sometimes they'll make sinful mistakes. I was fascinated by a documentary I watched a number of years ago about airplane crashes. And the research is overwhelming that most every airplane crash could have been avoided. Could have been avoided. Mechanical issues are always the cause, but those mechanical issues could have been avoided. What they discovered is the main cause of airplane crashes is that a member of the crew discovered the potential problem and either didn't bring it up or brought it up and was shot down and then didn't insist. And so the main cause of crashes were people who were unwilling to challenge their boss, essentially. This is the main cause of airplane crashes. My son-in-law, who's a airplane aficionado, he knows everything about every airplane that's flying today. He lives in Mumbai now, but when he was living there in Nashville, and he'd be over my house, I would ask him randomly. He said, "Barry, what planes are in the air right now over at Nashville?" He would know. He got an app, and he constantly is monitoring. He would tell me, "Well, there's an American airline flight that's coming in from Dulles. Usually arrives about 2:30, so it'll be showing up here shortly. Also, there's a Southwest flight coming from Houston Hobby, and it's about 30 minutes out." At any time, he'll know every fact. So whenever I'm in any airport or any plane, I always have to fax him the information. You know, here's the airport I'm at. I'm in terminal such and such at airport such and such. And then he'll text me back, say, "Yeah, the main problem they're having at that terminal is they can't figure out how they expand because of," and he'll go on to this whole thing. He knows everything. It is astonishing. And so I was mentioning this to him. He said Korean Air has been the biggest culprit. And so Korean Air has instituted a whole series of training for their pilots and co-pilots on interpersonal relationships in the cockpit, and actually having to retrain co-pilots to challenge, even to the point of having to raise their voice when they see a danger coming that the pilot is not listening to. Because that hierarchical mentality is so deeply entrenched in Korean culture that they have to have this special training to, you know, and they'll go through a whole simulation and, you know, it'll crash because they don't speak up enough. And so they'll have to go through it over and over until these co-pilots are trained, because crashes are coming, but they can be avoided. What a powerful illustration that is about the need we have to speak up. You know, we're going to experience some crashes, but most of them are avoidable as long as we'll speak up. So that's intellectual honesty, and I think it's paired with number three, intellectual courage. They probably go together. I must be willing to face new and even conflicting ideas. So this is the courage to challenge, but it's the courage to lay aside beliefs that you've had for a long time when you're confronted with new data that's forcing you to think differently. Intellectual courage, and finally, intellectual perseverance. Perseverance. I must be willing to get to the truth whatever it costs. Do I tend to give up when I experience intellectual barriers? Maybe there's a fifth one that I didn't put in there. Maybe you could put intellectual empathy. I don't know where that fits. Maybe it's a fifth idea, intellectual empathy. Can I see the insights in the viewpoints of others and the prejudices in my own? Some of my friends are really opposed to Joseph Prince. Do you know Joseph Prince is Singaporean pastor? Pretty popular, I guess. Got an international following and podcasts and probably blogs and everything like that. And I have a few friends that are really anti-Joseph Prince. And I like to irritate him, you know, by saying something nice about Joseph Prince. And I've listened to Joseph Prince, and I've been helped. I've been blessed. And I think that's intellectual empathy, is that he has insights that I don't have. Now, I don't want to follow Joseph Prince, and there's a lot of bones I want to spit out. But just because there's bones doesn't mean he doesn't have something very powerful to say. And if I sort of label him, put him in this category, I can't get the insights that he has, and therefore my life will not be as rich as it could possibly be. So I believe that every person made in the image of God has something to teach me. Every person, even a non-believer, especially non-believers, everybody has something to teach me. And can I get inside their mind enough to draw something that will help me, even though I reject almost everything else they believe and think? There's something in there that's good and worthwhile. And if I can get it, I'll be a better person for it. So maybe that's a fifth one. I don't know. All right, let's talk about some, let's get practical now, because I know you want me to tell you what to do. I'm going to tell you what to do. Skills. Ask the right questions. Ask the right questions. One of the things that I do when I create seminars like this is I try to ask myself all the right questions. And I realized when I was thinking about critical thinking that I do it naturally, intuitively. Most people don't do it. And so I had to ask myself, and I had to use some metacognition to go through my process. How do I analyze a particular situation? What do I do? And I realized I ask a whole series of questions. And so I began thinking about those questions. And I put them in, I think, do I have six categories there? One, two, three, four, five. Yes, yeah, six categories. So I'm going to give you six categories of questions to ask. And this is specifically referring to you're reading what another author is writing, or you're listening to a podcast from another author, or you're listening to a sermon from another person, or you're reading a blog or something from somebody else. These are the questions, or these are the six categories of questions that you ask to try to get to the truth. The first one, the first category is related to agenda. Agenda. What is the author's central purpose? What's he trying to do? Related questions, what is the author trying to get me to believe or to do? And what's the motive behind his purpose? Why does he want me to think this way? Anybody who writes or speaks or prints something or communicates, they want to change something about you. They want to change a thought process. They want you to think differently. They want to change something you do. Every time we preach, we want to change something, right? So the first question I have to ask myself is, what is he trying to change in me? What's the main thing he's really getting at? What does he want me to stop thinking and to start thinking? What does he want me to stop doing and to start doing? And even more importantly, what's his motive? What's the real reason behind it? I always ask those questions. You know, people think I'm a skeptic and I'm cynical, and I probably am a little bit, but my starting point is they've got some ulterior motive. That's my starting point. So I always start there. Except, you know, with my wife and people that I know and trust and love. But someone I don't know, my starting point is why? Why do you want me to do this? What are you trying to get? What's in it for you? You know, we're going to start this seminary, and we're all going to Asbury. But in the meantime, a university a reputable university in the United States has approached us, and they're willing to actually do, actually start a seminary here for us in the Philippines that they run for 3 years, and at the end of 3 years, they get out, and it's completely ours. And so before I left, Kevin York, who's my new boss, did I tell you I have a new job when we were here together? I have a new job. So I've been hired by Kevin York. I've been an MPD status on partnership, missionary, and doing the various things I'm doing. But Kevin has hired me. My start date is December 1. So I think my job title, they're trying to work on it now, is executive strategist. Sounds impressive, doesn't it? Yeah. Sounds like I'm kind of a big deal, doesn't it? Yeah. Nothing could be farther from the truth. But I actually have, I'll just tell you my, here's the job description. Kind of. So, assist the executive director, that's Kevin, to achieve organizational goals through strategic thinking, analyzing, planning, research, problem solving, consulting, and special projects. So that's my new job. Although I will continue to come to the Philippines and keep doing what I'm doing. So we were talking, I was talking to my new boss just about some things, and he told me this, what this seminary is doing. And you know, the first question that came to my mind was, what's in it for them? And he said, I don't know. He said, yeah, I wonder what is it. That's my first question. I want to know. I mean, I'm thrilled, and maybe their offer is totally altruistic. Maybe they just really love God and want to serve and give other to other people. There, you know, there's some weird people like that in the world who are really just actually love God. So maybe that's the motive, but I sure want to know. I mean, I want to get down to the bottom. So what's in it for them? And I don't mind if there's something in it for them as long as there's something in it with it for me. You know, we make transactions like that all the time. You know, I'll go down here at lunchtime and they'll give me, the people in the cantina, they'll give me something and I'll give them something. We mutually benefit, right? What's in it for me? I get food. What's in it for them? They get pesos. So, great. I don't mind that. I just want to know, what's in it for you? What do you get out of it? What's your real motive? Why are you pushing this so hard? You know, why does it matter? You know, when people come to me, you know, I imagine you got people all the time wanting you to list read or do a certain thing or teaching this or believe a certain way. And, you know, my first thought is, why? You know, why do you want me to do this? So that's my first place. You know, what's the author's central purpose? What's the central argument? Main thing, and what, how does it relate to my thought process and my behavior, and what's his motive behind it? That's agenda. Okay? Number two is authority. Authority. Who is this person to make such a claim? What qualifies him to make the claims he is making? I don't know if it was Sam or Gio asked me a question about when we read something, do we research this person's background? Yeah, of course, that's the first thing I do. So I was in this Asbury class for a while, and we're reading all these crazy books. And when I get a new book, a new author, before I even open it up, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to do as much research as possible is to find out who is this person, what qualifies him to talk about this particular topic. Why is he an authority on it? Who is this person to make such a claim? Do you have any credentials? Now, the more background in that area, the more credentials you have, you know, the more likely I'm going to give you an opportunity to make your point. I don't want to read a book about church planting by a dude who's never planted a church or by a dude who's just planted one church. I might read it, but I mean, in the back of my mind, I already know. I don't know how much you got to tell me. Maybe. I don't know if you're an authority. A lot of the people that I listen to, a lot of the podcasts, are people who are, they're not charismatic, they're not tongue talkers. And every once in a while they'll make some comment about speaking in tongues or words of knowledge or something. Now, when they start talking about that, I automatically know you have nothing to say to me about this. You have no knowledge. When you tell me tongues is the gift to be able to learn languages quickly, you've disqualified yourself in that area. Now, as soon as you get off that and back on the topic, now I'm going to pay more attention to you, right? So who is this person who makes such a claim? A little side note, but it relates to authority here. One of the things that I did in our last session, we're going to look at logical fallacies. And if you're interested in this and you want to do some more research, if you just go to YouTube and you just type in some of these logical fallacies, and then there's a whole list of various different videos that'll come up. One, I really liked one particular one. It's logical fallacies in the songs of the Beatles. So they'll play a Beatles song and show you where it's a logical fallacy. Another one was logical fallacies in TV commercials. And that was a fun one. So there's a logical fallacy called false authority. False authority. It's where a person who's an authority in one area assumes that he or she has the right to speak authoritatively in another area. And this is done all the time in celebrity endorsement. Right? So a celebrity endorses a product. And that makes people who like that celebrity think, oh, that must be a good product. But you see, that's a logical fallacy of false authority. That person may know something about acting or singing or writing songs, but they know nothing about that product. So one of the commercials I saw is it's a commercial for a particular camera. And they have a number of celebrities, Peyton Manning, who's a well-known football player, Justin Timberlake, a few others like that. And so they're on the panel, and they're talking about the value of this particular camera. And someone challenged it, what do you know about cameras? And then all of a sudden, the paparazzi come out of the woodwork, and everybody's snapping pictures of them. So are you kidding? We know everything about cameras. People are taking pictures of all the time. Well, they don't know anything about cameras. You see, that's a logical fallacy. But the commercial is actually using that logical fallacy illogically to get you to buy that camera because those celebrities support it. And this is done all the time. When you become aware of this, you'll start noticing how a person who has no credentials whatsoever to talk about that is all of a sudden being put forth as why you should buy a particular product. So I want to know authority. Right? So if a person's writing a particular book, I want to know his doctrinal, theological background. I want to know his training. I want to know what he's done. And the more those credentials pile up, at least I know what he tells me may not be true, but at least I have to listen to him. At least I have to listen to him because he is a recognized authority. So there's a whole set of questions based on authority. Who is this person to make such a claim? Presupposition. Oh, we're past our time. Let's take a break. 11:03. Come back at 11:15. 11:15. Snap. Yeah. Lourdes, do you think could we make it just a little bit warmer in here? Just a little. Yeah, because we're all. Or we could build a fire in the middle to warm our hands. Something like that. That would be fun. Our third category is presuppositions. Presuppositions, what are the underlying assumptions of the author? What are the values that drive his agenda? And what does he assume is true without proof? Presuppositions. Presuppositions. These are all important. And these are usually theological values that he holds. And I want to know what they are. I want to know what they are because I want to know how they affect what he has to say so that I can know if I want to accept it or how I want to process it. I recognize that he doesn't have to think like me. I don't care if he thinks like me or thinks differently. I just want to know how he does think. And that's going to influence the way I process the information. Number four is source. Source, where do his ideas come from? Who and what has influenced his thought process? How could I check to see if this is true? One of the first books that we read in our Asbury program was a book by an excellent scholar named Christopher Wright. And he's probably best known for his book, The Mission of God. Have any of you seen The Mission of God? It's a really thick book. We have it in our library here. And his premise is that mission is, that our mission flows out of God's mission. And that mission is a hermeneutical principle that by which we can understand all the scriptures. It's like an overarching theme, like kingdom or covenant, mission. So it really inspired me. I read the book, the first book. It's really thick. It's just a whole biblical theology, really, the idea of mission from start to finish. And then the first book that we had to read in Asbury was one of his books, but it was a smaller book, condensed version, which wasn't as good. But I noticed in it he made a comment or a few comments that caused me to wonder if he held to a particular view called annihilationism. Did we get to there? Did we get that? We talked about that in this class. Yeah, right. I thought we had. So he didn't come right out and say it. But what he said, I thought, I wonder. And so I thought, I need to dig a little bit more into his background. So I started digging a little bit farther into his training and where he works and who are the people that have influenced his ideas. And I realized that the organization that he's a part of was part of the John Stott Foundation. John Stott's considered one of the premier evangelicals of the 20th century, an Englishman, an Anglican. But wrote, you know, a lot of great books. It influenced a lot of people and a great man. But near the end of his life, he denied the traditional doctrine of hell and advocated annihilationism. So as I dug in, I realized Christopher Wright had been influenced, mentored by Stott, and I could see some of the influence of some of those ideas. Now, I disagree with that idea, of course, but I also now, I don't discount everything that Wright says, but now I just have a little bit better idea of his sources, who's he's listening to, and how that's affecting how he is presenting the truth and how he's exegeting the scripture. So I'm looking for the sources. Where do his ideas come from? And, I want to know academic training. If you go to Dallas Theological Seminary, for example, if someone's a Dallas graduate, I was listening to a guy the other day, and as soon as he mentioned Dallas, I had him pegged. I knew a whole lot about him. Dallas is sort of the bastion for dispensational thinking. We talked about dispensationalism last time, didn't we? Yeah, I thought we did. And so that automatically gave me a whole world of information to understand about his training, his sources, his background, where he's come from. So it helped me to understand what he was saying and to evaluate and analyze it for myself. So where do the ideas come from? The fifth is process. Process. How did the author arrive at his conclusions? How did he arrive at his conclusions? I'm hoping that in the process of his writing, he's leading me step by step. He's trying to take me somewhere. So he has an idea he wants to convince me of, and how did he get to that idea, and how does he present that idea? That's what I'm watching. How did he arrive at that conclusion? And because as I look at the process, I'm asking these questions. Are there flaws in his reasoning? Are there flaws in his reasoning? Like, up to this point, he had a starting premise, but up to this point, he was doing well. A, B, C, and then all of a sudden, there's a misstep right there in his thinking. And when I recognize that, I know everything else that follows, it doesn't follow logically from where he started. So he doesn't have a logical conclusion. I'm looking for, is there a logical and discernible progression of thought? How do you go from here to there? You made a statement, but you didn't back up that statement. How did you get there? I need to know how you got there. For me, it doesn't follow from there to there. So you got to help me see how. And often they don't. And so at that point, I have to question everything that comes after it, because there seems to be a gap in their logic that's leading me and leading them in a wrong direction. And the last category is consequences. Consequences. Where will these ideas lead? What will happen if everyone believed like him? When I look at contrasting viewpoints, one person makes a presentation on this side, another person presents this side, and both of them use biblical evidence. I look at the biblical evidence, and I weigh it out. In the end, though, what I'm really looking for is, if we lived like this, if we believe that, how would it affect the way we lived? How would it affect our relationship with Christ? How does it affect our relationship with others? And I'm looking for the consequences, and the consequences that look more godly and biblical. Like, these two both have biblical evidence, but it seems to me that this one would cause people to love God more and to love others more and to be more motivated to obey him. To me, that gives a high weight to that particular conclusion because of the consequences of it. It's those ideas will lead us closer to Christ and to look more like him. Any thoughts or comments about Adrian? Anything we've said here?
Question. With this criteria or questions that you place in what area do you find yourself most biased? In, for example, you don't find the perfect agenda authority in all of the questions that you ask, but somehow what is more valuable to you, the consequence, agenda, the authority? I don't know if you get the question.
Yeah, no, I do, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a good question. So out of those six, if I had to rank them in order, right, like, I think I want to know about his presuppositions. I think that's really important to me. His presuppositions, you know, his starting point. Because you can, if you start at the wrong place, start with a wrong presupposition, but if you reason flawlessly from that point, there's not one single flaw in your reasoning, you will still come out with a wrong conclusion. So presuppositions are more important than process to me. Because you could have a perfect process, perfectly logical thought progression, but you started with a presupposition that's not biblical. It doesn't matter how well you reason, your conclusion is going to be wrong. So I guess that's one of the most important things to me, presupposition. I think after that, consequences probably are Because, you know, we're always confronted with two good ideas that look, you know, that's he's got evidence. There's some evidence there. I find oftentimes I have to just decide based on, I think the consequences of this viewpoint would be more godly than the consequences of that. And then from that point, process is probably important to me. Because if a person starts with a right presupposition, but then the process is flawed, then usually the consequence will be flawed. I mean, usually the conclusion will be flawed too. Process. After that, just throw the rest of them. Did I put source? No, I care about source too, though.
I think that's my number one.
So. Yeah, that's. Yeah, I'm going to move that one up somewhere. Source. Yeah, where'd they get their ideas? Yeah, that might be number two. That was a good question. See, critical thinkers like questions like that because that's metacognition. See, I got to think about my thinking. But you're like that too, aren't you, Adrian? Yeah, you're wired like that. All right, so we're asking the right questions. Gather as much pertinent data as possible. As much pertinent data as possible. Compare and contrast with other studies, research, opinions, finding evidence. A lot of wrong thoughts are just the result of not enough data. You got the what? She just left. You might have to run, catch her. Do you think you got the right ones? Yeah, good. There. Gather as much pertinent data as possible, and then detect inconsistencies and mistakes in reasoning. Now, the way you do that, the last section we're going to look at, I just want to start you on this process. There is a lot of, these are called logical fallacies, and there's hundreds of them. All you have to do is type in into any search engine logical fallacies, and you could spend the rest of the week following those different sites. So I've taken a few that I think we are most guilty of, and let's run down the list and make a few comments about them. So these are logical fallacies. These are flaws in reasoning process. The first one is called anecdotal evidence. In this fallacy, stories of experience are used to prove a point. Although it is valid to use personal experience to illustrate a point, such anecdotes don't actually prove anything. Your friend may say he met Elvis in the supermarket, but those who haven't had the same experience will require more than your friend's story to convince them. Now, we're probably the most guilty here, and anecdotal evidence tends to sway people's thinking more than any of these other categories. People generally are more influenced by an anecdote, a testimony of something that happened to an individual, than they are by logical, biblical, rational reasoning. So one of the ways this happens often, it's used in offering messages almost all the time. Something like this. Here's a case example. Congregant A was having serious financial problems. God told him to give a significant amount to the building project. He did, and he received a major promotion at work. Of course, the implication is if you give a significant amount to the building program, you'll get a major promotion. Now, everybody wants a major promotion, so people will give to the building fund. This actually works. It works, yeah. It's an excellent way to manipulate the flock. It's an excellent way to manipulate the flock. Now, let's make a point here. Anecdotal evidence can illustrate a biblical truth, idea, or point. So we're not discounting anecdotes, because if we did, we wouldn't have any sermons left, would we? Because we use anecdotal evidence to illustrate our points, to make it clear, even to, as you know, to persuade even also. So anecdotes do have a persuasive power, and there's no, we're aware of that. But anecdotes can't actually prove. Anecdotes should illustrate as opposed to prove, you see. So what the Bible teaches is it is a general truth that if you give, it will be given to you. If you give, it will be given to you. Now that's a general biblical truth. What the Bible doesn't say, if you give X amount to a particular thing, you'll get X amount of benefit, right? So that is a fallacy to even hint at the possibility that if you give to the building project in faith towards God, X, Y, or Z will happen to you. That's just a logical fallacy. There's no proof for that. God has is under no obligation to do anything special based on a contribution you made in any kind of special arrangement, a special offering, or anything like that. So this is a logical fallacy. It doesn't prove anything, but it does work. Yeah? Yeah? And all God's people said, yeah. Oh my. Forgive me, Lord. So can you use an example like that? Sure. But you have to be clear with people. We are not by any stretch of the imagination suggesting that if you give to this project, X, Y, or Z is going to happen to you. You give to this project because God moves your heart. You give to this project because the Holy Spirit puts it in your heart and you want to be a part. And consequences and results, we leave that all to God. Right? Yes, sir.
What I usually do when I use myself as an illustration is that I will always challenge them not to really do what I did, but for them to hear from the Lord,
yeah,
and obey God,
yeah,
not to imitate what I've done,
yeah,
because I heard from the Lord, and the Lord will also the one speak to you or lead you to do not the things that I've done. But
I get that. Yeah. I get that. But when we tell, so the Lord led me to do X, and as a result, Y happened. Now, you're making an argument, but it's not a valid one. You're making an argument, and people are hearing that. You understand what I mean by an argument? Argument doesn't mean you're arguing with people. You're presenting a truth. That's what an argument is. So I'm presenting the truth. But what people are hearing is that if I give, God will do this for me. And that's a logical fallacy. What we can do, we can teach the Bible, give the Bible presentation. The Bible teaches that God loves to bless his people. He is a giving, loving God. And that blessing, the giving generosity, initiates blessing. That's the fact. That's the biblical truth. For example, here's an example for me. Here's what happened. Now, that does not in any way mean that you can expect the same thing to happen to you, or that you should do what I did in order to get what I got. You give because God's put it in your heart, and we trust the results to him. Does that make sense? Do you see how we use the logical fallacy in so many different ways? So I don't want you to be afraid of anecdotes. We've got to keep using them. But remember, they have a persuasive power, and we have to make sure that what's really persuading people is biblical truth, not our anecdotes. Okay? The next is called ad hominem. Have you heard that term before?
Yeah.
It's Latin. It means at the man. So in this fallacy, the argument is directed at the man. This is an attack on the person making the argument rather than the argument itself. Most political ads are based on this. This fallacy is also seen when a position is rejected because some other easily criticized person believed it. For example, well, that's what Hitler believed. You want to be like Hitler? Let's break down this ad hominem fallacy. So very common in a political argument. In a political argument, someone is presenting their case for a platform issue that they care about. Maybe better education for poorer classes. Right? They present that. This is their argument that's being presented. Now, the other political party who's challenging them, instead of actually dealing with their argument and responding to why that won't work, they instead attack the person. You said, oh, yeah, well, that person, that political candidate, sends their kids to private schools because they've got all this money. That's an argument ad hominem, you see. You're not addressing the issue that's being presented. You're just attacking and calling into question the integrity, the character of the person. So this is a common fallacy that Christians use when they attack some fallacious idea or argument to defeat the idea of practice. So, for example, we might be presenting, let's just say someone is presenting the views of a particular evolutionist. So he teaches this and this, and he's been married and divorced 4 times. You see, that's argument ad hominem. Now, as a Christian, 4 times married and divorced. What a terrible person. Yeah, you see? And so what that's doing is it's not addressing the logical arguments that this evolutionist has put forward. It's bypassing that and just attacking that person. This individual's personal inability to maintain a healthy marriage probably doesn't have anything to do about his evolutionary beliefs. But he's immediately discredited because of the argument ad hominem. Now, Pastor Julius brought up an interesting idea the other day. This would not be an argument ad hominem if someone is presenting, let's say he's presenting, here is the proper methodology for child raising. Well, if 2 of his children are in a federal penitentiary, then that's not the argument ad hominem to bring that up. That's addressing his arguments directly head on, right? So he's saying, if you will do this in child raising, this is the way to do it to get results. But the reality is, his method has already proven to not work because that method did not work in his own children. So that's not argument ad hominem because it affects the actual area that they're talking about.
Pastor Bo.
Yeah, Adrian.
I encountered this situation a few years back. There's someone who volunteered to us to train our teachers in the kids' church and how to properly do kids' church,
right,
something
yeah.
like that. And then, and this person, this woman, her children are not really okay in the church. They're not regular attendees. They're not disciple enough. And then some of the team in our team and our staff wants to accommodate her, but me, I told that argument
yeah.
that it's not really evident in our kids.
Yeah.
So that's not ad hominem in the same way you mentioned.
No. Yeah. I think that's a valid biblical criteria, and you have plenty of biblical evidence to back it up. You will know them by their fruits, right? We have all sorts of examples of the requirements that are placed upon elders. Why are those requirements placed? A person in a position of authority has to model and emulate the character of Jesus Christ. So the standards for pastors, etc., all those are applicable in a situation. So if a person is going to teach a particular concept, that there has to be some evident fruit in their life. So you're not casting aspersions on their character. You're pointing out the biblical reality that they don't qualify. Now, if their children were fine, but this person, maybe this person, maybe there's an unrelated issue, you know. I'm having a hard time thinking of one, but something that Christians may be offended by, you know, that she does, or something that some people don't think are appropriate, and said, well, she can't teach in the children's church because she was, you know, she had an abortion as a young woman. Now, that would be the argument ad hominem right there. That's attacking the person, not attacking the person's actual credentials to do that particular topic, right? Or if you're in a debate or discussion with a person, to throw out something like that, well, how would you know you did such and such? Mm-hmm. When that such and such has nothing to do with what they're presenting. That's the argument ad hominem. Yeah. Or something, you know, the other example, you know, well, that's what Hitler believes. So someone puts forth an argument, or they're presenting a case, and you happen to know a noted sinner, a noted reprobate, a noted bad person who believes that, and you say, well, so-and-so believes that. Do you want to be like them? That's not actually addressing the issue, you see, because even the worst people that have ever lived have actually believed some things that were true. Right? And so that's the argument ad hominem. That's a logical fallacy, and it shows up all the time in our thinking process. Keep going. You okay? Appealing to the gallery is the next one. Appealing to the gallery. In this fallacy, you attempt to win acceptance by appealing to a large group of people. For example, millions of people have believed in Jesus and the Bible. This belief has had a great impact on their lives. What more evidence do you need that Jesus was the Son of God? Are you trying to tell those people that they're all mistaken fools? Sometimes this is called the 50 million Frenchmen fallacy. 50 million Frenchmen fallacy. And that title has an interesting origin. It comes from a song written in 1927 in a play. This is the jazz area in a jazz era in America. And the jazz era is a deliberate reaction against Victorian and essentially biblical morality. So during the 1920s, there's a real shift in traditional moral values in the United States, and there's a big wedge, an open door of a lot of questionable morals, loose living, etc. And there was a play that was written, and there was a song about 50 million Frenchmen. And the basic idea is, the song is an attack against traditional morals and opening up the possibility of a little bit looser sexual license, you know. And then the point is, the French do it, and 50 million Frenchmen can't be wrong. The idea is, if so many people do it, how can it possibly be wrong? Now, maybe your kids tried this logical fallacy on you, you know? Can I go see? But everybody's seeing it. That's a logical fallacy. It's appeal to the galaxy. It's the 50 million Frenchmen. Or maybe this is the worst one. One of the other pastor's kids. He let his kid go. Why can't I go? Because I'm your daddy and not him. It's the 50 million Frenchman fallacy. So sometimes we build up. So many people believe this, it must be right. No, there's 1 million Muslims in the world. Does that mean they're right? Appealing to the gallery. Begging the question. This is called circular reasoning. Circular reasoning. You assume as a premise the conclusion you wish to reach. So you're assuming as a premise. You're trying to prove something, but what you're trying to prove, you're already assuming that it's true and using it as a premise to prove what you're trying to prove. You're just arguing in a circle. For example, someone says, your boss, a potential boss, your resume looks impressive, but I need another reference. You say, Jill can give me a good reference. Great. How do I know that Jill is trustworthy? I can vouch for her. Well, you see, the premise is the same as the conclusion. What I'm looking for is a third-party, independent validation. And you're providing me someone who is being validated, not on a third-party basis, but you're the one validating her. You're validating your own evidence when I'm looking for third-party evidence. Now, cynics, critical, non-biblical critical thinkers accuse us of begging the question. So, how do you know the Bible is true? Well, you know what our answer is. The Bible says it's true. That's begging the question. That's circular reasoning, right? See, you're using the Bible as your source to prove that the Bible is the true source. Well, the way you handle a situation like that, of course, is because it's the idea of ultimate truth is that everybody has some ultimate basis for their verification of what they think is true. So the way you cut back at a person like that is you ask them, okay, so what do you believe? Well, I believe science. Why? Why do you believe science? Because science has proven itself. But that's the same circular logic, you see. You trust in science because science has proved that science is right. I trust in the Bible because the Bible says the Bible's right. There's no difference between us. We just have faith in two different things. And so then the next question I would ask is, what difference does it make now? Do you think if you had two people, if one person believed that they were the product of random chance, that there's no real value or purpose for them in the universe, the universe doesn't care about them at all, they're just molecules in motion, or a person who believes that they're the result of a transcendent, caring, all-powerful, all-loving being who desires the very best for them. What difference will that make in the way people live? And that, to me, that's consequences of an idea, right? So, Sam.
How about using statistics in validating our...
Yeah. Hang on to that question. Bring that up because we're going to talk about a logical fallacy that uses statistics. So there's a place for statistics, but statistics are often used wrongly. Let's break for lunch now so we can beat everybody down to the cantina. And all God's people said, amen. And we'll come back at 1 o'clock. All right?